Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. I'm holding what looks like a black knobbly rock. It is in fact a polymetallic nodule from deep down on the ocean bed of the Pacific. But what's remarkable is it contains the four metals, cobalt, nickel, copper and manganese, needed to make batteries for electric cars. And as the market sees an exponential rise in electric vehicles, a more sustainable solution is urgently needed. Today's guest is the CEO and founder of The Metals Company, Australian entrepreneur and businessman Gerard Barron, who was granted the first license from the International Seabed Authority to investigate the nodules. And if the scientific research continues to go well, he plans to make 280 million car batteries over the next 30 years. Gerard, it's fantastic to be here holding
this
polymetallic nodule, which is absolutely fascinating to me. Tell us the story. How has all this come about?
Well, it's a rich history, which of course, for those people listening in the UK, started with the Royal Society funding an expedition way back in the 1870s when explorers wanted to know what lay on the bottom of the ocean. And they converted a gunship, the HMS Challenger, into a science ship and took the guns off and put science labs on. And the steam piston had been developed and they didn't know how deep the oceans would be, of course. So they had tens and tens of miles of rope and they set sail. And they came back 4 years later, having surveyed the oceans. And so they dragged this dredge, effectively it was, off the back of the boat and recovered it and started mapping the depths of the ocean. And so what they found was that these nodules are in many parts of the oceans, but there was only one part that was of particular interest. And it's a part that we're now exploring intensely. It's about 1,000 miles off the coast of Mexico. And it's the area of interest because these nodules precipitate the metals that are in the seawater or the sediment upon which they sit. So they grow a little bit like a pearl grows, if you like. And if you look to the right of where this area is, you see the Rockies and the Andes, and they were covered in nickel and copper, and they formed through volcanogenic explosion. And so all of the metals spewed into the Pacific Ocean, and they all settled on this one particular patch. And this is why this is the part of the ocean that is of interest. And it's really tight and concentrated. There's only, you know, the oceans are big, right? 360 million square kilometers in size. And talked about 280 million. Well, we have 150,000 square kilometers where we can collect these nodules and make 280 million electric vehicle batteries. So thankfully, Mother Nature put it all in one little pocket. So that's what we're up to.
And are they just sitting, minding their own business on the seabed? They're not attached to the floor, are they?
No, that's right. They're like golf balls on a driving range. And they're kind of waiting to be collected and turned into batteries is, you know, the best I've concluded. And of course, if you get to understand how the mining industry on land works, it's a very invasive process, right? You've got to destroy carbon sinks, remove all the trees and the plants and the soil to eventually get to metal-bearing ore. Whereas here, you have to go through 4,000 meters of water, admittedly, but that's not too hard. And then they're just sat there and we get to collect them and, you know, we don't have to dig or tunnel or blast to find them. And it means defining the resource is easy because we literally can take pictures of it. If this were on land, we'd be drilling thousands of holes trying to imagine what it looked like under the surface. But here we just literally look at it.
You talked about the exploration all those years ago. Hmm. When was it discovered that these nodules contain all the metals for car batteries? And how on earth did you discover that and get involved in this?
Mm. Well, so when the HMS Challenger came back, and if you go to the Natural History Museum, if you're lucky enough to go in the back archives, or in fact down to the Royal Society in St. James, you can see everything they brought back. And so they soon realized that these nodules were the ones to be focused on because even, you know, way back they wanted these metals, particularly copper when they realized its important value and nickel. And so they realized quite quickly. And then, of course, it was actually in the 1960s And it's a rich history, actually, which I rarely tell. But in the 1960s, they started to, you know, say, look, we should think about exploring this area because we're going to need more metals. And so there was something else that really got it started. And it involved the CIA. You couldn't make this up.
Wow, it's a great story.
There was a Russian submarine that sank in the Pacific Ocean, and this was during the Cold War. But the Americans had listening devices in the Pacific Ocean, and the Russians didn't. So when this submarine disappeared, the Americans knew pretty well where it was, but they knew that they couldn't pop out and pick it up because the Russians were in the seas as well. And so they were kind of shadowing one another. And so what the Americans decided was that they would use these polymetallic nodules as the reason for being out there. And so they actually engaged Howard Hughes and they built the boat, the Glomar Explorer, and they started to prepare to, in brackets, collect polymetallic nodules. And in fact, I have someone working on our project who actually worked on the project back in the 1970s. And I had this chat with him about, when did you realize that it was a CIA operation? He said, about 6 months before the end, because we were asked to design these big claws. So basically what they wanted to do was to go down and collect, you know, the cylinder, because the Americans wanted to know what did the Russians have that they didn't have. And there's actually a movie on Netflix about it now, which I recommend to watch, because a lot of the documents have now been released and ambassadors of the Russian ambassador sending news back to Moscow saying, you know, I think it's just polymetallic nodules, whereas other communications were, no, they found it. We should be on them. We should definitely stay. But in the end, they disappeared and the Americans went and collected this submarine. But that was enough to, because of the hundreds of millions of dollars that the CIA poured into it, it got the industry started. And soon after, Lockheed Martin were involved, Shell, BP, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, all these big industrial names started to build systems so they could collect nodules. And Rio Tinto built a onshore processing plant. And so this was back in the mid-70s. And so it was all heading down a path towards commercialization. But then they realized, well, who should we ask if we're allowed to do this? And it beggars belief because, you know, they spent so much money, but they didn't actually have the right to do it. And so Henry Kissinger wrote a letter to all of the ambassadors of the United Nations and said, hey, we'd like to claim this part of the Pacific Ocean so we can collect these nodules. And, you know, you can imagine all the ambassadors at the UN sat around saying, did you get that letter from Kissinger? He's like, yeah, I did. And they said, no, you can't do that. And so everyone had to stop and go home and do something else. And then finally, fast forward to 1982, when UNCLOS was agreed, stands for United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. And what UNCLOS declared was, as a sovereign, you own everything within 12 miles of your coast. You have an economic right to everything within 200 miles, but beyond that, it's not yours. In fact, it's going to be deemed the common heritage of mankind. And so it's owned by everyone. And they set up this organization called the International Seabed Authority, which is a little bit like the United Nations. It's made up of 167 member states plus the European Union, and they govern the high seas. And their job is to put in place a regulatory regime to allow the development of this industry and any other industries that would be in the high seas. And that's where we find ourselves today. And I think what we did is we were actually the first private company to apply for an area, because when they drafted UNCLOS, they were very focused on allowing the developing countries, the poor nations of the world, to participate, because they didn't want it dominated by the rich nations. But knowing that a poor nation would never be able to put an application together, they allowed a developing country to sponsor a private company. I mean, we were in this space. We were studying the law of the sea. We were understanding how it would all work. And so we saw the commercial opportunity and we approached a developing country back in the mid, 2006, 2007, about sponsoring an application of ours. And so that developing country was Nauru, quickly followed by the Kingdom of Tonga. And we were the first private company to apply for an area And we kind of, I think we lead the way now, you know, as a company. We're busy doing all parts of the project that need to be done. For example, the offshore engineering, we're building our first production system. We're completing our onshore pilot processing work. We're in the middle of our environmental impact studies. Our boat is constantly going backwards and forwards to the area, filled with scientists. We're baselining all of the data from the region so we can see the impacts. We're developing the technology that will allow civil society to look at what we're doing, will allow the regulator to look at what we're doing. The goal is to be in commercial production by 2024, which is only a few years away. It's also a perfect time because if you look at the demand supply curves for the metals, they all start to bifurcate around that time because, you know, people are only starting to understand what it means to move electric, because if we stop using fossil fuels, it means we have to rebuild the infrastructure upon which we operate on, you know, the electric cars. There's no point having coal-powered power plants to charge our electric vehicles. That's ridiculous. But it takes metal to build all of this stuff, right? Metal to build the batteries, metal to build the windmills, metal to build the solar panels, and on it goes. And
so when you first started to explore, were you not necessarily thinking about electric car batteries? You were looking more at the nodules for the high content of those key metals and the fact that, I think I'm right in saying, there's very little wastage in these either, is there?
That's right. You're right to say we were focused on metal production with lower environmental impact. Because today, those metals are being used, well, copper is used as a conductor material, of course. Nickel is used mainly to make steel, stainless steel. And of course, the demand for those metals is continuing to increase without electric. It's continuing to increase because we still have billions of people living in poverty around the world. The industrialization of the developing world is continuing at a pace. And we saw the last time there was a commodity super cycle was in 2003, and that was driven by China because they were going through a massive transformation. But now there are many other nations who are doing the same. And so we talk about electric vehicles now because the alignment between the resource, what's in the nodules, is so perfect for what the electric vehicle industry needs. But there are many other demand drivers as well, and they include the industrialization, like I mentioned, the fact that population growth continues. You know, by the end of this century, we'll have 2 to 3 billion more people, and that puts more demand on metal production. And so electric vehicles is obviously a very topical issue for us.
It's a topical issue for me as well, the electric vehicle market. And I do remember many, many years ago being, you know, among the first people to have a Prius, a hybrid car, and then being absolutely horrified watching a documentary to see what went into creating the battery and how much of the planet was destroyed. I mean, there are still many, many downsides to what goes into an electric car battery. I'm thinking CO2, cobalt and child labor. I mean, will you just talk us through some of those negative sides to what's going on now and the downsides for the planet?
Yeah, well, what really, I guess, got me all in on this, because originally I was attracted to it as a business idea. But then when I started to understand climate change and what an existential crisis was in front of us, and so I then started to investigate, well, if less fossil fuels means more metals, what's the true impact of more metals? And I think that will be a really sad awakening for people as they start to understand this, because metal production largely happens out of sight, out of mind. You don't see it. Last year, the mining industry generated 190 billion tons of waste. Now, to put that in context, all municipal waste around the world totals 2 billion tons. So 2 billion compared to 190 billion. And it's not just the waste, but the waste is impactful, because land-based ore bodies have some serious disadvantages that we don't have, because our nodules precipitate, they grow, and they take the metals that are in solution in the seawater or in the sediment. And as a result, you know, we don't have any of those nasty elements like mercury or arsenic, which unfortunately land-based mining does have. And so land-based mining resources either form through volcanogenic activity or through wet leaching that happens over tens, hundreds of millions of years. And unfortunately, you know, you can't use that material unless you extract those nasty elements. And that means that you can't release them into society because they would poison everyone and destroy all of our nature. And so the mining companies have to keep them. They're called tailings. And these tailings dams are not perfect because they're literally like a big dam full of poisonous stuff. And we've seen in Brazil recently that these dams, even when they're owned and operated by the best in the mining world, fail. You know, we saw in Brazil where dozens of villages were wiped out and hundreds of lives were lost and ecosystems poisoned. And so that's one thing, that waste and the nasty tailings generated from land-based mining. But then you've also got to look at where the metals are coming from. And I always say, if we had our time again and we took a planetary perspective, we'd carry out extractive industries in parts of the planet where there is the least life. You know, we wouldn't go to the rainforests. We'd go to the desert because there's no creatures that are visible. Yes, there are some creatures that come out at night and there's some creatures that are living in the sand, but the comparisons are obvious, right? And that's what we're operating in. We're operating the biggest desert on the ocean floor. But unfortunately, the mining industry has been forced to go to more remote places. And these places often involve, particularly for car batteries, our rainforests, either in the Congo or in Indonesia. Now, the thing about rainforests is that they're very, very biodiverse ecosystems. But they, from a climate perspective, they're also our carbon sinks, because that's where they sequester enormous volumes of carbon. And as we want to get access to the metals that lie beneath these forests, we've got to cut down the trees, we've got to remove all the plants, we've got to dig up all the soil. And as a result of that, we release like gigatons of CO2. And, you know, of course, people sometimes say, yeah, but the oceans are full of carbon as well. Yes, they are. But in our case, the carbon is kept at 4,000 meters below sea level in the sediment. And so we don't have any impact on the sequestered carbon. And so increased metal production on land, which is the way it would be heading if we were not getting this industry moving, has some really, really horrible consequences. And they involve destroying these carbon sinks, having a massive impact on all of the fauna and biodiversity, generating lots of tailings, moving communities out of the way so they can obviously mine. And of course, often in these remote places, it's a double whammy because they're having to build power, and often it's coal-fired power, to be able to operate these mines. And because they're so far out of sight and often in developing countries, the regulations are not very good. And so it means rules get bent. And if I think about some parts of Asia, the tailings that I referred to that are so toxic, because of where some Asian countries sit on the tectonic plates, they can't build tailings dams. So what they do is they dump the tailings in the deep ocean. So they literally pipe the tailings like 1,500 meters below sea level because it's stationary there. So it's a horrible situation. And I'm sorry for your listeners because it will be upsetting. And a lot of people don't want to be confronted with it. You know, it's like if you see a starving child on TV, a lot of people turn away because it's like, oh, you know, it's really uncomfortable to look at that. But unfortunately, we have to face up to this stuff, you know, because we have to take responsibility for the planet, if not for our sake, for our future generation's sake, because the planet will be fine. The planet has been through many iterations of itself. Continents have been together and separated seven times. I mean, it's 4.5 billion years old, yet our impact in the last 100 years is really, really noticeable. We have to address the obvious signs.
With all of these things, Gerard, there are always critics. Mm. Where would, for example, David Attenborough stand on hoovering up nodules from the seabed? Presumably there's some kind of life deep, deep, deep below there. And what about Greenpeace too? Because I know you've had the Greenpeace Warrior boat in the ocean where all your research is going. Can you give us a sense of what the critical voices might say?
Yes. Let me start with Greenpeace. Greenpeace have an argument that I read it in the paper today. Recycling is the answer. And so Greenpeace won't engage with us on science.
So they won't come on your boat and see what you're doing and
talk to your scientists? Well, they came and visited our boat, but we have sent them many invitations to sit with our science team and understand what it is we're doing. But they have a simple line. It's called protect the oceans. It's an easy thing to get behind, right? Yeah. I want to protect the oceans. I consider myself an environmentalist. But the biggest risk to the oceans is climate change and global warming. And so you would have to be a little bit daft if you thought that protecting the oceans didn't involve reducing CO2 emissions. But the Greenpeace solution to that is to say, well, if we recycle more and consume less, then we can solve this problem another way. And let's hope that we come up with a new technology that doesn't require these metals. But that's a roll of the dice. That is a roll of the dice that has no supporting evidence that there's any likelihood of it being an outcome. And on the recycling front, as an organization, we are absolutely committed to being out of this industry in 50 years. I hope less, because the world is moving towards a what we call a circular economy, where we have to stop extractive industries. But the hard, cold facts are that, and just imagine it yourself. If you and I go and buy a new electric vehicle today, then in 10 years' time, that battery will be maybe end of life and will need to be recycled. And it will be recycled. 100% of the metals in that battery are recyclable. But the question is, where do all the battery materials come from between now and then? And, you know, it's not just cars we're talking about. We're talking about heavy transportation and ships and trains and aircraft and power plants and home storage and so on. And so we're going to need to produce billions of tons of these metals if we really want to move away from a warming planet. And so my frustration with, you know, the environmental groups is, when I took over as chairman and CEO of the company, you know, I thought I'll be able to sit with all of the NGOs because they surely want the same thing that I want. But unfortunately, their business model is a little bit different. And they have the cheek to say, oh, but you're marketing, you're greenwashing. You know, it's like, hang on. I spend 90% of my money on science, on research, whereas Greenpeace is, I think, probably the other way around. They don't spend much money, if any, on research at all. They'll sail the Rainbow Warrior out to stick up a sign every now and then, but that's not going to provide solutions because there's no easy choices and there's no perfect solution either. If there was, if I could find one, then I'd be in that business. I'd be doing everything I can to support that. Nuclear is a great example, right? You know, the world had a choice to go down a path of nuclear power. It chose not to. We probably missed a massive opportunity. Unfortunately, that opportunity is gone now, I think. And the likelihood of it becoming a viable power source at scale is very, very low. So we have to deal with the facts that we have. So on the green pieces, what they're worried about is several fronts. One is, well, what about we're going to disturb the ecosystem down there. We're going to scour the seabed. But when you look at the environment we're operating in, you want to operate where there is the least life. And so to begin with, let's baseline what life is down there. And the evidence is that there's around 13 grams of life per square meter. And
13 grams, that's an interesting way of
13 grams of living matter per square meter. And that's mainly bacteria living in the sediment, living in the mud. Because if you look down there, all you see is thousands of miles of nodules lying on the seafloor. And every now and then you'll see a sea cucumber or a starfish, but you don't see plants. You don't see fish swimming around. You might see an octopus every now and then, but unfortunately, you don't see those living matter because there's no food. There's no energy down there. And all of the food that gets there decomposes down through the water column. And so it's an area of very low energy. And so the starting point is there is less life to impact. But the fact is, what we do is we put a pair of trawler tracks or car tracks through there as our collector goes through. And we can engineer our system to minimize that impact. And then Greenpeace would point to the fact that, yeah, but 30 years ago, we ran a trial and the area hasn't recovered. It's like, hang on, what are we talking about? You can still see the car tracks. If you go to many of our deserts, you know, look at the Dakar to Paris rally, you can see car tracks that went through there 10 years ago, 100 years ago. And you compare that to what rehabilitation doesn't happen with land-based mining.
Well, it's compare that to the indigenous tribes that are displaced or the CO2 emissions or the great swathes of the Amazon that have disappeared. We interviewed an explorer recently who did a documentary for Amazon Prime on the Amazon. And he said, it's absolutely heartbreaking. There's nothing romantic about going to the Amazon anymore. Are there concerns that you're disturbing any important life on the ocean bed?
Well, I can't help but think that if Sir David had a chance to look at the case to collect polymetallic nodules, as opposed to other types of metals that are in the ocean, because there are also, you know, like mountaintops of metal, chimneys and seafloor crusts that also contain metals that we do not advocate collecting, because that is a mining operation. Whereas what we're doing is collecting these loose nodules off the ocean floor. And, you know, I would welcome the opportunity of sitting with Sir David to say, look at this case and look at the fact that the area in which they're located, firstly, is very low sea life, and we can collect them with very low impact, and compare that case to the alternatives, because unfortunately, that's the way we have to start thinking. We have to start thinking about trade-offs, because Sir David thinks about the planet, and we can't just think about oceans or forests. We have to think about planetary impact, because all of these systems are interconnected. The biggest threat to the ocean is rising CO2 emissions, because they're warming the oceans. You know, you look at coral reefs are all dying through coral bleaching because everything's getting warmer. So there's a lot of people, a lot of conversations you have to have. And in the case of Sir David, he's the vice chair of that NGO. And I guess he's heard their perspective and he's yet to hear mine.
So holding my polymetallic nodule, which is quite comforting actually holding it in my hand. How many of these, what sort of quantity are we talking about for a car battery?
The good news is that there's higher concentration of these metals. And so the average car electric vehicle will have around 155 kilograms of those four metals. And to produce those 155 kilograms, we'll need to collect 6 tons of our nodules.
And that's a lot, processing. Isn't it? A lot.
It's a lot, yeah. But you compare that with on land, where we would have to collect 64 tons. And so that means a lot more energy, a lot more waste, a lot more matter that you've got to move, if you like. And of course, the other thing is there is everything in that nodule that you hold in your hand we use. So there's a lot of other matter in there that is also goes into society. A lot of manganese silicate, for example, that's used to make steel. For the car battery itself and the copper wiring, we'd have to handle 6 tons. And, you know, we'd lift them ashore, we'd put them on our transporter, and we would process it at a processing plant, which of course we would power with renewable power and so on. But yeah, extracting metals is it's a big industrial activity.
And how do you get them? I mean, I can't imagine. I sort of can imagine actually them sitting a couple of miles down in the dark on the seabed. Do you hoover them up? Have you got, do you use drones for as part of it all?
At the moment.
What's going on under there, Gerard?
Yeah. Well, just think of it as that golf driving range, and we put a tracked vehicle because the soil is quite soft, but we put a tracked vehicle down there. So it has like caterpillar tracks on it, and it glides along the ocean floor, and it uses a great engineer. In our case, it uses an engineering system known as the Coanda effect, which allows us to lift the nodules with minimal impact on the area. But of course, there will be some impact, but very minimal. And so we then lift up the nodules, suck them up, put them into a basket where we leave behind the sediment, because there will be some mud, think of it as. So we leave that behind, and then we put the nodules into what's known as an air riser. Think of it as a massive straw that goes 4,000 meters attached to the boat. It gets compressed air injected into it about a third of the way down, and that compressed air expands, rises, creates a vacuum, and it vacuums up the nodules from the ocean floor to the production vessel. And another way to think of it is like harvesting a paddock of wheat, because we'll have more than one harvester down there. In time, we might have 6 or 7 or 8 of them just moving along the ocean floor. And that's one of the advantages of an ocean resource, that on land, you have to spend billions of dollars building the infrastructure around the ore body, because the ore body ain't moving. And so you've got to build a deep water port, a railway line, roads, power, water supply, villages for people to live. Whereas in our case, we don't have to do that. We have to convert an asset into a ship for example, or build a new ship, float it on out there. We can be in production soon after. And it's all mobile because it's like slowly moving across the ocean floor.
It must feel quite incredible for you. I mean, you've been a businessman for a long time, an entrepreneur for a long time. Do you ever sort of sit back and pinch yourself really and think that you are on the verge of doing something that hopefully will make a massive difference, not just in your lifetime, but also in your children's lifetime, and contribute to helping save the planet, which, let's face it, is in absolute crisis right now, climate change wise?
Pinch myself, no. Slap myself sometimes. It's like, why did I take this on? Because, you know, when you wake up and at times you are being villainized by, you know, Greenpeace, who are saying that we're greedy, money hungry. So that's upsetting because, you know, of course, we are a for-profit business. We've just announced that we're becoming a public company, actually. But the reason we're doing that is we need capital to do this. You know, we can't do it on $2 donations. We need to raise billions of dollars. And so the most efficient way of getting access to that capital is in the private sector. But look, I'm attracted to impossible challenges. You know, a decade ago, this looked like an impossible challenge. Today, it's looking very likely. And so it's exciting to be doing something that's never been done before.
Often when we do these podcast interviews, we start with a bit about the person and where they came from. And actually, it's been gripping to hear all about this. But I would like to end maybe on just hearing a bit about you and where you came from. Because you grew up in a quite remote dairy farm in Australia, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I grew up on a dairy farm. I was the youngest of five. And I went to my local university, had four jobs in my first year. But I realized that there was no room for a fifth job, so I better rethink this whole money-making business. And so I started my first company at university. And I've been self-employed, if you like, ever since. And I've been lucky enough to build some great companies around the world. Australians have a sense of adventure. And so, you know, I look for any excuse to get on a plane and travel. And so I was manufacturing automotive batteries in China in the early 90s and building distribution networks around Europe and Australia. I had a telecommunications business that I sold to Singtel. And then I started a software as a service business in 2001, which I grew to 30-odd countries. And so, yeah, look, it's been an amazing journey. You'd argue I've never had a real job. You know, it's been quite strange yet. But I think everything for me is pointed to this moment, to be honest. I went through my own little midlife crisis in 2013, 14, where you ask, why am I doing this? Reflect on your own personal relationships, your work relationships, and what's the scorecard going to look like at the end of it? Why am I doing this? And so it allowed me to rethink where I wanted to spend my time and energies. And, you know, this has now become my 168-hour week activity, which is probably makes me a little bit dull.
It doesn't make you dull at all, but I'm also slightly intrigued about you growing up on a dairy farm. There's quite a romantic image for me of that. Was it an idyllic childhood, and were you in the middle of nowhere in Australia at that point?
Yeah, I was in the middle of nowhere. We have another term for it, which I probably can't repeat on this podcast. But yeah, I mean, I had a disabled mum, so that was a big impact in my life. And she's still of great mind. She's still alive today. And she approaches 90, and, you know, she's always been my hero. And it's kind of funny. People often say, how the hell did you get from a dairy farm to here? And like all of us, you know, you just deal with what you see in front of you. And I'm not sure how I got here, really, other than I was determined not to be a dairy farmer.
Did you spend your childhood milking cows and all that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Did you?
I mean,
Come on, indulge me a little bit.
Oh, my God, totally. If I wasn't at my mother's side, I was at my father's side, you know. He was also the local windmill repairer.
Was he?
So nothing more I would enjoy than going for a day out with Dad to climb up a windmill. And he would be the guy that everyone called, you know, if their windmill broke down. And if your windmill breaks down, things die, mainly animals. So I used to milk the cows every single day. Every single day. And in between, drive tractors and machinery. I mean, it was idyllic, really.
And was it a beautiful part of Australia? Where were you?
Yeah, it was on the Darling Downs, which is about 3 hours inland from Brisbane. Yeah, it was idyllic. I mean, unfortunately now it looks like hobby farms. A lot of the farmers have sold them off to city dwellers who turn them into 80-acre blocks and, you know, run horses. But yeah, no, it was an absolutely great upbringing.
That sounds amazing. I could talk all day to you. We've been sitting here with a beautiful view, which I think we should just share with our listeners. We're looking out over Hammersmith Bridge. So you're a long way from home right now, or original home. But it's been fascinating talking to you, and best of luck with the project. I shall treasure my nodule and look forward to driving a car with the battery from those nodules. Thank you, Gerard.
Thanks, Helen.
Well, you've been listening to Gerard Barron, CEO, chairman and founder of The Metals Company, the man who plans to revolutionise the way electric vehicle batteries are made using polymetallic nodules from the seabed in the Pacific. I hope you've been as fascinated by Gerard's story as I have. It's been a pleasure to have your company today. Thanks for listening. You can download and subscribe to our whole series of inspirational chats at convex.podbean.com, or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or simply ask Alexa. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.